So as I mentioned earlier then, we're beginning a new series this evening in the book of Daniel. And I would like us this evening to consider this opening chapter, Daniel chapter 1. In his essay entitled The Biblical Doctrine of the Trinity, the great theologian Benjamin Warfield makes this comment. He remarks upon the odd human tendency to think in threes. And I suppose nowhere is that odd human tendency more evident than in Christian preachers. You put a preacher in front of a Bible passage, and the passage might contain one verse or it might contain 60 verses, but almost inevitably he'll feel this pull to find within it three main sections. And I could go with that pull this evening then when it comes to Daniel chapter 1. There are different methods I could use to get us our three main sections here. I could focus on paragraphs, and that would leave us with a neat threefold division. So verses 1 to 7, that's one paragraph. Verses 8 to 16 is a second, and verses 17 to 21, a third paragraph. Or I suppose I could be clever and I could focus on word repetition, and I could highlight the three references we have to God giving. So verse 2, God giving Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. And then verse 9, God giving Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And then verse 17, God giving the four youths learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And so we could organize the passage around those three references. And so, as I say, there are different methods that we could use. But in actual fact, I think the editors of the ESV knew what they were doing when they inserted only one major break in this chapter there between verse 7 and verse 8, leaving us with just two main sections. I think that's the best way of dividing the passage, and so I'm going to resist my preacher's three-point instinct, and I'm going to go with that this evening. And those two main sections, then, that we have here, they're quite different from each other. Most conspicuously, I suppose, they're different in size. The second is considerably longer than the first. But still, fairly conspicuously, they're also different in atmosphere. The first section, I would suggest, has a distinctly threatening feel to it, while the second has a rather thrilling feel to it. And for that reason, then, rather than viewing this passage merely as two consecutive chunks of material, one coming after the other in the normal way, I think it's helpful to picture it as kind of shaped like a V. And so, first of all, we have what I'm going to call this threatening slide down, down, down to verse 7. That's where the V bottoms out. But then from that point, everything suddenly changes, and from verses 8 to 21, there's this thrilling sequel, as I'm going to call it. And so that's how we're going to approach our passage this evening. We're going to follow the V down and back up again, considering first of all the threatening slide and then the thrilling sequel. So first of all, the threatening slide. This is verses 1 to 7. And I want to highlight three aspects to this. And first of all, a threatening mismatch. A threatening mismatch. This is verses 1 and 2. I used to attend a conference when I lived in a different part of the country. And the chairman at this conference was always the same man, and he had a reputation for going on a bit. And so in each session he would give notices and he would introduce the speakers, and it would all be punctuated with anecdotes and other assorted tangents, and it really would end up taking up a fair amount of time, so much so in fact that some people would deliberately turn up late in order to miss the tiresome preamble. Well, the book of Daniel has no tiresome preamble. You can't turn up late with this book. You need to be fully switched on and concentrating from the very outset. And when you are concentrating from the very outset, you notice something in the opening two verses. You notice a series of contrasting pairs. So for one thing, there are two kings mentioned, King Jehoiakim and King Nebuchadnezzar. Then again, there are two kingdoms referred to, Judah and Babylon. Then again, there are two worship sites that feature. There's the house of God, i.e. Yahweh, and there's the house of his God, Nebuchadnezzar's God, or probably his gods is actually the more accurate translation. It's a plural word, and Nebuchadnezzar would have been a thoroughgoing polytheist. And so I'm saying then that those opening verses, they propel us very much into a polarized situation where we have these two conflicting sides. And if our biblical antennae are working well, we'll recognize then that this isn't some unexplainable one-off situation that we're dealing with here. Rather, it's one episode in a much larger story. The Bible as a whole describes a great conflict between two sides. It's introduced as early as Genesis chapter 3. There you remember in the Garden of Eden, God announces, doesn't he, just after Adam has faithfully eaten that forbidden fruit, God announces that history is from now on going to be a war zone. And on one side in that war zone, there will be the seed of the serpent. And on the other side, there will be the seed of the woman. And Daniel chapter 1 then is merely zooming in, if you like, on one little clash within that broader biblical historical conflict. The seed of the serpent here is represented by Babylon. The seed of the woman is represented by Judah. I suppose if you want a more New Testament set of terms, we could say that this history-long conflict is between the world and the church. In which case, Babylon, of course, represents the world and Judah represents the church. But whatever vocabulary we use, that's the bigger picture, I'm saying, within which these two verses, with their contrast, their polarity, that's the bigger picture within which they belong. And what is unmistakable in those two verses is that at this point in history, about 605 BC, the conflict is a mismatch. Babylon very much has the upper hand here. Babylon is on top. Babylon is calling the shots. Look at the strong and unequivocal verbs that are used of Nebuchadnezzar. He came to Jerusalem. He besieged Jerusalem. He brought the vessels from the house of God. He placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. These strong, robust verbs that are used in connection with Nebuchadnezzar. And it makes painful reading then. These are not nice verses. It's a threatening mismatch. And it's not unfamiliar, is it, to us? So often in the Bible, so often in history, the conflict between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman is a mismatch in exactly the same direction that it is here in Daniel 1, verses 1 and 2. Indeed, don't we recognize the same mismatch as we look around us in the Western world today? It's the world and not the church that has the upper hand. The church in Britain and Western Europe is small and weak and voiceless. The world, on the other hand, is big and powerful and throws its weight around. So that's the first thing here, a threatening mismatch. And then secondly, a threatening culture. A threatening culture. And this is verses 3 and 4. And we discover here then that it's not just temple vessels that Nebuchadnezzar wants relocated from Judah to Babylon, it's people too. Now, at this point, we're not talking about the exile proper that landmark event in Old Testament history. That will be about 20 years later, when, of course, Jerusalem has not merely been besieged and plundered in this way, but has been completely flattened by the Babylonians. This is just an initial wave of relocations, of exiles. It's the relocation of Judah's elite. And I want you to look at the description that we have then in verse 4 of the Judeans who were caught up in this particular relocation. And we're given quite a list of descriptions. But there's one particular item I want you to notice. And it's there near the start of verse 4. Youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom. That's the phrase, skillful in all wisdom. That's an interesting word, the word skillful there. It's a Hebrew word that you might actually be familiar with. We talked about it fairly recently in looking at one of the Psalms. It's the word maskil. And you might be familiar with it because it appears in its Hebrew transliterated form in the titles of some of the Psalms that we have. A maskil of David or whatever we sometimes read. And it's also then a word that is used in Proverbs. And it's a word then which refers to more than just intellectual knowledge. And it's a word that even refers to more than just good judgment in the kind of secular sense. I mean, I prayed this evening that Theresa May might have good judgment in negotiating the whole Brexit process, and that's, I think, a reasonable thing to pray for and to talk about. Good judgment, discernment, wisdom in that loose secular sense. But of course, the Bible, and particularly books like Proverbs, it talks about wisdom in a much deeper sense. Wisdom, skill, to use the translation of maskil that we have here, that is essentially this: it's viewing the world from a God-centered perspective. That's what we're talking about here. Viewing the world from a God-centered perspective. And so you see, here are these youths then, being relocated from Judah to Babylon. And yes, they have good appearance and they're good students and all the rest of it. But along with that, we're being told that they had imbibed, presumably from infancy, this God-centered perspective. They had had parents who had perhaps used Solomon's curriculum. They'd used the book of Proverbs, perhaps. And they had faithfully taught their children to view the world from a God-centered perspective. And these youths then, with that wisdom in its full biblical sense, they are now being relocated to Babylon. And here's the thing. Look now at the last line of verse 4. What's going to happen to them? They're going to be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans. And think about that. That literature then. And Babylon produced lots of literature. It was a prolific culture in that sense. That literature, it would have been a million miles removed, wouldn't it, from all the literature that these lads had been exposed to back home, the Law of Moses and the Psalms of David and the Proverbs of Solomon and so on. Religiously, this Babylonian literature would have been awash with stories of pagan gods. Morally, this literature would have been awash with depravity, with loose morals that were nothing like the morals written into the Law of Moses. And in the face then of this tidal wave of seductive Babylonian culture, it just seems inevitable that in the lives of these Judean lads, that God-centered perspective, carefully inculcated by devout parents, it will be swamped and it will be overwhelmed and it will be blasted away. And again then, that resonates with us, doesn't it, in the West today. I mean, here we are at church on a Sunday and at various points perhaps during the week, going to the Bible and seeking to construct from the Bible a God-centered perspective on life. But all the time, there's just this tsunami of our secular culture coming at us. Not just for us through one medium, through literature, as is the case here, but through all kinds of media, through films, through sitcoms, through Facebook, through numerous media. A secular culture, seductive with its loose morals and its appeal to self-determination and self-fulfillment. And it threatens then to blast our God-centered perspective to smithereens. So a threatening mismatch, a threatening culture, and then thirdly, a threatening agenda. A threatening agenda. This is verses 5 to 7. Because regarding these youths then, relocated from Judah to Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar had an agenda. And that agenda was to bring these youths into conformity. It was to make them out and out thoroughgoing Babylonians. And notice the interesting way in which Nebuchadnezzar pursues this agenda with these lads. He does it with what I'm going to call a disguised heavy-handedness. A disguised heavy-handedness. I mean, it is heavy-handed on the one hand. Look at verse 7. Their names are to be changed. And I mean, changing someone's name just in general, that's a pretty heavy-handed thing to do, isn't it? I mean, your name, it's your identity is bound up to some extent with your name. And so for Nebuchadnezzar to insist on their names being changed, just at that point, we're already dealing with something that's very invasive and intrusive here. But not only that, all the four names that are mentioned here, they all refer to God, or to Yahweh. And in each case, they are replaced with names that refer instead to Babylonian gods. And so you see this reprogramming, this reconditioning of these lads that is going on. That Yahweh is being driven out of their identities. That's the aim. And instead, these pagan deities are being put at the heart of who these boys are. So it's heavy-handed stuff. And yet, it's disguised, and it's disguised by the detail we're told in verse 5, where we're told that the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that he ate and of the wine that he drank. And you see the cleverness of that. It's making Nebuchadnezzar appear such a fatherly and such a benign figure, isn't it? Oh, well, you boys, you know, you can eat my food and drink my wine. And so it doesn't look as heavy-handed as it is. Because this reprogramming agenda is being clothed with this apparent kindness and warmth on Nebuchadnezzar's part. Again then, don't we see echoes of this in the West today? I mean, increasingly there's a pretty heavy-handed pressure, isn't there, on the Christian church to conform and to become good modern Brits, jettisoning the Bible's position on homosexuality and transgenderism and such like, and assuming instead British values on these matters. It's pretty heavy-handed. And yet, of course, it's disguised because there are all these perks. If we do conform, you know, Christian schools will then get glowing Ofsted reports. And Christian unions will then be allowed to have stalls at the freshers' fairs. Perhaps we're approaching a day when then, and only then, Christian churches will be allowed charity commission status still. When we conform, there are perks that are offered for doing so. And again then, it's heavy-handedness clothed in benevolence. And so I'm saying then that this is the threatening slide that we have in verses 1 to 7 The clouds are gathering in these seven verses. They are menacing verses. We have a threatening mismatch. We have a threatening culture. And we have a threatening agenda. But then let's move on, secondly, this evening to notice the thrilling sequel. The thrilling sequel. And this is verses 8 to 21. And you can see from the very first word, can't you, of this section of the chapter, that there's a change of direction. It begins with that word, but. And again, then, I think we can identify three aspects to the thrilling sequel in verses 8 to 21. And each of these three aspects answers directly to the three aspects that we've just considered in the first part of our sermon. But we'll be addressing them in reverse order. You'll see what I mean in a moment. So first of all, then, a thrilling gesture. A thrilling gesture. And this is verses 8 to 16. And this answers then to the threatening agenda that we've considered just a moment ago. And the gesture to which I'm referring then is Daniel's resolution. Daniel is, of course, one of these four lads who have come from Judah. Of course, there were many, many more than just these four, but these are the four that the book is going to focus on, and particularly, of course, Daniel is the one who is going to be focused on. And Daniel then resolves that he, verse 8, will not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. This perk that we talked about just now, Daniel is not going to receive it. And I'm calling it a gesture. And I think that's important that it is that. Daniel here is not, in my opinion, obliged as a Jew, obliged as a man of God to do this. Now, some have said that, some have assumed that he is. Perhaps he's obliged to do this because the food that he would be offered would be unclean. But it doesn't seem as though that is the reason for Daniel's resolution. I mean, the wine wouldn't be unclean, and yet he also denies himself the wine. Others have said, well, maybe this food, the meat would have been offered to idols, and that's why Daniel won't eat it. But then, why should not the vegetables have been offered to idols as much as the meat? So I don't think those are the reasons. I don't think Daniel is doing this as a matter of strict principle. Rather, it's this gesture as I'm describing it. Some of you who were into sports in the 1990s will remember the footballer Roy Keane. And Roy Keane was a Manchester United star and a rather volatile individual. And his relationship with the club for which he played ended rather badly. It ended with Manchester United ending his contract and getting rid of him. He fell out with the manager, Alex Ferguson. And he was very upset by this situation, Roy Keane. He was very annoyed that they were getting rid of him in this way. And so one thing he did to express his annoyance was this. He kept hold of his company car, the car that the club had given him. It was a lovely Audi car, and he kept it for a further 3 months after his contract had been terminated and put as many miles on the car as he could do. And he comments on this situation in his autobiography, and this is how he comments on it. He says, every little victory is vital. Every little victory is vital. Now, I'm not commending to you this evening Roy Keane's conduct in that situation. I'm not saying that that's how you should behave toward your employers at all. But it is an interesting phrase, an interesting principle, an interesting rationale there. Every little victory is vital. And I think that sums up Daniel here in Daniel chapter 1. This is a little victory. And it's something then that he was at liberty not to do. He was at liberty as a man of God to eat the diet. In fact, we discover later on in Daniel that he that he does feast in the normal way in the Babylonian kingdom. He was at liberty not to take this step, but he took it to secure a little victory. You see, here is Daniel, and every day then he is immersed in this Babylonian culture, and he's been called by everyone a Babylonian name, and it's just everywhere, it's all around him, it's the air that he's breathing. But then it comes to tea time, and as the food is brought out, and as there are these plates brought to everyone else with lovely juicy meat on them, as a plate of vegetables is brought to Daniel, and it puts him back, every evening it puts him back into defiant, revolutionary, Roy Keane mode. And he gets up again the next morning, and again it wears off as the day goes on because he's immersed in Babylonianism. But then it comes to tea time, and again the vegetables come out, and again he's back in defiant, revolutionary, Roy Keane mode. And you see, it meant then that because he was in defiant revolutionary mode through this little victory, day after day after day, it meant that when the stakes became higher, and when he faced a situation where moral issues were at stake, and where he had, as a man of God, to stand on principle, it meant it was much more natural, much more organic, much more easy for him to do so, because he had kept himself in defiant revolutionary mode in this way, in this small victory, tea time after tea time after tea time. And I wonder whether there are applications for us, just one that strikes me. The Lord's Day. Now, of course, the Lord's Day, in my view at least, and I know in the view of many, probably most of you, the Lord's Day itself is a matter of principle. It is a biblical command. But of course, how exactly we observe the Lord's Day is left to a large degree to our own individual decisions. There are certain things, of course, that we must do. We must gather together for worship. But there are many details that are not given to us in Revelation. And I suppose then that there are many things that perhaps many of us in this room don't do on a Lord's Day. And we could do those things without sinning. And yet, not doing those things and keeping the day as distinct as possible is a little victory. It's a revolutionary thing. It's saying we're not part of this world. And I'm not going to run the marathon. And I'm not going to go out to the shopping mall. I'm not going to become like everyone else, even though perhaps I have Christian liberty to do that. I'm not going to do that, because I'm not one of them. And I'm going to make this revolutionary statement by keeping the day different in all its details, not just in going to church once or twice, but in all its details. I'm going to keep the day different as a revolutionary statement. It's not some stuffy legalism. It's a revolutionary act of defiance. I don't belong in the world that's going to St. James's Park or to the shopping mall. I belong to a different world, to a different king. And those little victories then, like for Daniel, make it so much more natural and easy when we come to the bigger situations where moral principles are at stake. It makes it so much easier then to stand and to be a Daniel, even when the lions are roaring, because we have Sunday after Sunday gone back into revolutionary mode again and again and again. Otherwise, we just merge, become flabby in our thinking, And then we come to a situation where we're threatened with the lions. And it's much harder to stand because we haven't been pursuing those little victories Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. So we have then a thrilling gesture, but then secondly we have a thrilling preservation. And this is verses 17 to 20. And this answers then to the threatening culture. Remember we said that there was this danger then. It's just this seeming inevitability that all these Judeans, propelled into Babylon, thrust into this culture with all its literature that was so attractive and beguiling, there was this seeming inevitability that they would just be overwhelmed and overtaken by it all. But we come to verses 17 to 20, and we read that with these four at least, it's not so. And we read then in those verses of their success in learning and the way that they come to impress Nebuchadnezzar and impress him more than anyone else that he has in his kingdom. But the key thing to notice is the reappearance in verse 17 of that same word that I focused on before, skill. Skill in all literature and wisdom. Again, it's that word maskil. Again, it's that strong word that's used in Proverbs. Again, it's that word that refers to God-centered perspective. And that was the thing that I said looked like it would go. It would be just washed away by this tidal wave of Babylonian culture. But it isn't. These lads, they don't just excel intellectually, but they excel in godliness, in biblical wisdom, in skill, in maskil. And how do they do so? They do so because God gave them that skill. The text says, God preserved them. Day after day, having to read pages and pages of Babylonian literature, which had the potential to so rewire them. And yet, no, they keep on thinking biblically, thinking in godly ways, because there's a supernatural preservation here. And that's a wonderful encouragement for us then, isn't it? I said before that we too live in the face of a tidal wave. You're going back into it tomorrow. The wave coming toward you as you switch on the TV, as you open the newspaper, as you log on to the internet. The wave is coming at you. But we have a God who can preserve us. A God who can keep us thinking biblically. It seems on the face of things, you know, two Sunday services, a midweek meeting, a few quiet times. That on the one hand. On the other hand, all these media coming at us. But God, through the titbits of those Sunday services and our Bible readings and the other means of grace, God, through those titbits, can preserve us and keep us strong and able to withstand the tsunami. We need to pray that for ourselves, don't we? We need to pray it for this week. Lord, give me skill. Give me God-centeredness. Give me clarity of vision in a world that is intoxicating and befuddling. That drunken stupor that we saw in 1 Corinthians 15 this morning. A world that corrupts good morals, as Paul quoted Menander in that passage. Give me steadfastness, clarity. Give me insight into the hollowness, the emptiness, the bankruptcy of it all. The speciousness of it all. Pray that for yourself. Pray it for your brothers and sisters in this congregation. Pray it for the children. Pray it for your children and the children in our church. Pray that in a seductive culture, we might be given divine preservation. So a thrilling gesture, a thrilling preservation, and then thirdly and finally, a thrilling reversal. And this is verse 21, and this answers then to the first point we looked at tonight, the threatening mismatch. We're told in verse 21, and it seems like a fairly throwaway remark, Daniel was there, that is in Babylon, until the first year of Cyrus. What's that about? Well, it's not telling us when Daniel died. We know from chapter 10, verse 1, that Daniel did not die in the first year of King Cyrus. What's the point of the reference to Cyrus? The point is that Cyrus marked the end of the Babylonian era. Cyrus was Persian. He was a Persian emperor. He was the start of the new Persian era that followed the Babylonian one. So that's the point of Cyrus here. He marks the end of the Babylonian era. And we're being told then that Daniel was there then. Daniel was in Babylon still when the Babylonian Empire faded away, floated into oblivion. And you see what I'm getting at then, but when I say it's such a thrilling reversal of what we were talking about at the start of our sermon tonight, that mismatch and the ascendancy of Babylon there in verses 1 and 2. Babylon is this indomitable force that just dwarfs little Judah, God's people, the seed of the woman. Babylon is just enormous and irresistible, it seems. And then we come to verse 21. Daniel's still there. Babylon's not. There, in verses 1 and 2, Judah is being removed. Everything from Judah, vessels, people, Judah is being removed before the face of this mighty Babylonian Nebuchadnezzar. And we come to the end of the chapter. Babylon's been removed before the face of the Judean Daniel. And is that not a little glimpse of the way this whole story is going to go? I don't mean the whole of Daniel, I mean the whole of the Bible. I said earlier that this is just one little episode, isn't it, in a conflict that is Bible-long, history-long. And isn't verse 21 a little glimpse of how the whole thing is going to end, the whole story? And you come to the end of the Bible, and we have another Judean, another from the tribe of Judah, the lion from the tribe of Judah, not Daniel, but Jesus. And there he is at the beginning of Revelation, shown us in the center of the throne. And as Revelation continues, what do we have? We have Babylon. Not little historical Babylon. Babylon in the sense of the entire seed of the serpent. The entire world order from all of history. Babylon what? Disappearing. Falling. Being driven away. And Jesus stands in mighty victory as Babylon floats into oblivion. That's the way it's all going. The mismatch is very temporary. The mismatch is for a time. And of course, and I didn't mention this, but we're told, aren't we, there in verse 2, that even the mismatch is under God's sovereignty. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. Even our present defeats, even our present weakness, the ascendancy of the world over the church in Britain and Western Europe today, that's not an accident. That's under God's sovereign hand. He's directing that. But today will come when there will be this thrilling reversal. And the world that has had the upper hand time and time and time again throughout history, Babylon the Great, will fall. And the greater than Daniel, Jesus, will be victorious.
Hallelujah.
And will claim this world as his own. Amen.